This is The Conversation. It's episode 175 with Justin Favela. He is a Las Vegas-based artist. Vegas, baby, Vegas. And he is born and bred there, has deep roots in the casino hospitality industry through his family. He's also partaken at one time in working the casino business. You will hear about that and much more. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for this podcast is theconversationpod.com. I highly recommend that you go to the website to pair the images there with what you're hearing about Justin's performances slash happenings of Family Fiesta that he did at the Crystal Bridges Museum in Arkansas, as well as at inside of Michael Heiser's Double Negative. That and also his pinata pieces, his pinata papering of a motel, and so on. Go check all that out on the website. And and Justin is also, you will find this definitely a nice factor for our conversation, that he is the co-host of a podcast called Latinos Who Lunch. Not unlike Ladies Who Lunch, only it's Latinos Who Lunch. So you know that he's got a lot to bring to the table, and indeed he does. We talk about just about everything under the sun once again, from his family roots in the casino business to his Latino identity and the various pieces he's done, which relate to that, and more as well. There's also a brief tangent of some political nature, and I will just give you sort of a little spoiler that I think he was probably right, and I'll talk more about that on the back end, but just a little spoiler on that. Before we do get into the episode, because we don't have much on the back end, I do want to take this opportunity to let you know, in case you are not already aware, that we have set up Patreon, the monthly donation and gift platform for the podcast, and it would be great if you could jump on there if you haven't already and consider becoming a monthly donator. You can donate for as little as $1 a month, but the more you donate, the more gifts and rewards that you get. So it's an alternative to PayPal. PayPal donations are still very welcome, and you can find those through the regular website. If you want to go to Patreon, you can find a link to that through theconversationpod.com, or you can just go to Patreon, PATREON.com, and look up The Conversation Art Podcast, and you will see it. See our page there. So thank you very much in advance for your support. We still are not advertising for the show. We will be, I hope, in the near future. And when that time comes, you will not hear me be talking about Patreon and PayPal at the beginning of the show. But until then, I will. So your donations make this show happen and keep it going. So please do, if you haven't already, go to either Patreon or PayPal and make a donation to the podcast. Your support is very much appreciated. Thank you so much in advance. Now let's get to that conversation with Justin Favela. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your listening. Talk to you briefly on the back end. Ciao for now.
Hey, how's it going?
It's all right. How are you?
Good, good.
So you're in Vegas, first Vegas guest, and you're a lifelonger, right?
Yes, I was born and raised here in Vegas.
Got it. And now I was there about a little less than a year ago, and I was around the university, so I guess I didn't see a lot.
Uh-huh.
I guess I didn't see a lot of the city, but where are the nice parts of Vegas?
Where are the nice parts of Vegas? Well, I guess it depends on what you think nice is.
Yeah, well, I'm interested to hear what your interpretation would be.
Well, I was raised on the east side of Vegas, which uh-huh. is the brown side, really. And I love the east side for that because it's, you know, a lot of people make fun of it and call it Little Mexico, but that's why I love it.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's just like any other kind of big town, you know, new town in the West. It's a bunch of strip malls, basically, and then you got your suburbs. So
right.
in the 90s, we had a big boom here. So there's a bunch of McMansion neighborhoods everywhere.
Right.
Like on the outskirts of Vegas. Not even on the outskirts anymore because the city just keeps expanding, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, we have, you know, there's really nice neighborhoods. Some parts of Las Vegas, you know, have parks. It's just like any other town. But when people visit Vegas, you know, they usually just see the Strip, so they don't really see all that.
Right. Yeah. No. I feel like and I had been there before several years prior, but I didn't spend really any time other than part of an evening on the in the Strip area, just driving around. But the you know by the yeah. university, you sort of do have that classic strip mall kind of. Style of architecture and spread. And so I guess it sounds like that's kind of consistent with most of the city.
Yeah. It's a big grid. That's all it is.
Yeah. And are you in the east? Are you in the east side now?
Technically, yes. I'm the artist in resident right now in this building downtown called the Jewel. So I live now, I'm downtown living in the old part of Vegas on the old strip. So it's very central.
Right.
But I'm still renting a room on the east side for when I have to head back.
Right. Got it. So are you living large now being downtown where you are, would you say?
Oh my goodness. It's the dream come true.
Yeah.
So it's a big studio space. It's a storefront basically.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a stairs connected to a loft above it. So I get up every morning and then just come downstairs and I have a big studio space.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool. I've been here for about 5 months now and hopefully I get to stay a little bit longer than the original 6 months that I had committed to.
Right. And as part of being the artist in residence, does that require you to do a certain amount of like demonstration or outreach or talks or whatnot?
I committed to having an open studio for everybody to come visit once a week. And I'll do events here and there when they need some color. But it's really not that much. The owner of the building just wants me to be here to just do my thing because, he's a big supporter of the arts, so it's a really cool, unique opportunity.
Right. And for people who may have an image of the old strip, as you referred to it, you know, does that include things like the Flamingo? Is that the old strip or is that too new?
Okay. So the Flamingo is actually from the 40s. So it is pretty old. I mean, in Vegas history, right? Mid-century is old for us.
Right.
But the original strip, it was actually Fremont Street in the downtown area. It's like where the Golden Nugget is, the El Cortez, Binion's Horseshoe.
Right.
And it's kind of become this weird entertainment district after they put a big canopy over it in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the area of town that I'm on. So that's actually just called Fremont Street.
Okay.
And then the strip is anything, I guess, south of Sahara. So from where the Sahara Casino was all the way to basically the state line now is the strip.
Right, right.
On Las Vegas Boulevard.
Yeah. When you see the strip is kind of, it's sort of the quintessential, it shows its scars in the bright of day, you know, like when you see it during the day, it has that, you know, cause everything's, you know, there are no bright, well, there might be bright lights, but especially, you know, maybe in off the beaten path a bit, you see just sort of these austere kind of sad, maybe buildings and whatnot. I don't know. Maybe it's a lot different on the old strip where you are, but you know, I guess I'm just trying to wonder if having grown up with it, if you know, what sort of your perception of it, of the sort of the glitz that kind of comes on at night and shuts off during the day or, you know, whatever, what's your take on all that?
Well, you kind of, you kind of get desensitized a little bit, especially because, I mean, I'm a very nostalgic person, so mm-hmm. A lot of my family works on the Strip, so I remember one of my first, like, traumatizing memories was, like, my whole family worked at the Dunes. That's where the Bellagio is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was 5 when they imploded the Dunes and to build the Bellagio. And my grandma, like, everybody got displaced. So, like, my grandmother and my aunt had to find a new job because there were maids there. And my aunt was a server there, and my uncle worked there. So it's like they all had to scramble and kind of figure things out. And then this building literally just, like, imploded in front of me. We went to go watch it implode because it was this huge, you know, spectacle.
Right.
Thanks to Steve Wynn.
Right.
And so I didn't understand what was happening. Why are we celebrating this? Like, this is a huge loss for my family. What's going on?
Right.
And then it just kept happening. Like, through, like, 2007 was the last big implosion, I think.
Uh huh. Wow.
Actually, they just imploded the Riviera last year. So
wow.
So you kind of, I don't know. After a while, you just learn to let go and know that the architecture here is just. Everything's very ephemeral here. Everything's going to go away. So,
right.
I used to work at the Neon Museum too. So that was a way for me to kind of hold on to a lot of my memories and old Vegas. Cause they save a lot of the signs from the buildings.
Right.
Because they're just always turning over. But, I think there's just a different sense of reality here when it comes to the permanence of architecture.
Right. And
yeah.
And your family, when they were displaced from, was it the Dunes?
Yeah.
Where did they go then, to another casino once they found something?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. So, okay. So my grandma and my aunt, they went and worked at the Barbary Coast, mm-hmm. which was, like, across the street from Caesar's Palace. And then one of my other aunts, she went to and worked at the Harrah's. But so, yeah, they just kind of keep moving around casinos. And now the Barbary Coast is gone, and it's this called the Cromwell now, I think. I don't even know anymore. So
he's right.
Like, who cares?
Right.
and now my aunt works at... My grandma's retired, and my aunt works at the Golden Nugget. So people just kind of keep moving around. And thankfully, there's really strong unions here, the Culinary Union, the Culinary Workers Union, who also is, you know, they work with the guest services and the hospitality industry, basically.
Right.
Anything that falls under that umbrella, they really take care of their people. So... thankfully, there's always jobs.
So if you're in If you're in cleaning as well, you're in the hospitality industry and you're under that union.
Yeah, the Culinary Workers Union is from any kitchen worker to, like, valet to a housekeeping department.
Right.
It's all under the same. Yeah.
So speaking on behalf of your various family members, and did you say your mom too has been, like, in cleaning or something similar?
Yeah, my whole family. So
right.
my mother has cleaned the Palms Casino since it opened in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
My stepfather has cleaned the Luxor since it opened in the 90s.
Wow. So your mother and your stepfather essentially do the same type of job?
Yeah, he's a utility porter, not just a porter. He cleans carpets. So
oh, okay.
You know,
got it.
There's a yeah, but
right.
It's the same, you know, same department.
But all that, I wanted to get all that information to set up this sort of question. It sounds like mm-hmm. if you're in a union, you know, in hospitality, that you make a decent living considering the field.
Yeah.
And you have a lot of rights as opposed to especially being in the cleaning industry. In non-union locations, I mean, that is, as well as, you know,
totally.
As well as other hospitality. So I wonder, I guess, part of the question I'm getting at is, Is Vegas even maybe a destination because of those unions for a lot of people?
Totally. I mean, that's what brought my family here in the late 70s and 80s.
Right.
If once you got that union job, like, you're set, and
right,
and you worked that job for 20 years, and, you know, for example, one of my aunts who's been a server for the longest time, she's been working at the same place for so long, she gets like 2 months off every year.
Wow.
And, you know, she's capped out, but she has all this seniority, and they can't let her go just because of that, you know?
Right.
So
right.
It's when I, for example, have worked in casinos, growing up here, and have had the opportunity or have been in those unions. And when I left those jobs to be an artist, my family thought I was crazy. What are you doing?
Right.
Leaving
right.
That security, like,
right,
you're set, dude. What are you doing?
Yeah.
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 So,
what have you done?
Yeah.
What kind of work have you done in casinos?
Oh, my God. Oh, my first casino job was, I was a roller coaster operator at the New York, New York.
Uh-huh. How was that?
And then it was fun. It was fun.
Yeah.
I really love messing with people on the roller coaster. But, I mean, all I did was push a button all day, so it got boring after a while.
To what extent, though, was your job, customer interaction? I mean, turn on the charm and, you know, calm people down, that kind of thing.
Yeah, we had shifts, you know, like you had to start as a greeter, and then you work like the queue area, then you had to seat people, and then you were at the control panel. So you kind of just shifted around all day.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so were you doing that at one point full time, or was that kind of more of a part time in addition to your art?
That was full time at a high school. I was a roller coaster operator.
Got it. Right.
Yeah.
Right. And was that 40 hours a week pretty much?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was going to school.
Oh, wow. Got it. Okay. So
yeah.
I guess part of what I'm getting at for, it sounds like what you were doing was quite a bit different than the rest of your family, but another sort of question/concern, even though,
mm-hmm,
you know, even though relative, say, to most of the rest of the country, you know, working in the hospitality industry, Vegas sounds great because of all those union benefits, but have there been health, you know, repetitive stress and whatnot type of issues for any of your family?
I think so. I mean, just physically, those jobs really beat you up. So,
yeah.
I mean, I come from, my family doesn't like to complain about that stuff, but, you
right,
know, you can see it. Like,
right,
you know, my aunt has been in, one of my aunts that works at the Golden Nugget now, she's been doing the same thing for, I don't know, 22 years now. So, it's really grueling work, you know?
Yeah.
Especially once you get to a certain age, I mean, anything really. So,
yeah.
So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, it's all, they put everything into perspective and you work past it. And, you know, we're here to work and we're here to, you know, create opportunities for our future family members. So that's kind of the goal there.
Right. Well, that is an interesting point to make, you know, regarding your being an artist now, because obviously you're the iconoclast or the, you know, the mold breaker of the secure union job, you know, by going on into art. So not only did you not sort of grow up in any kind of art family, from what I gather, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, but also you were like,
yeah,
I'm taking the family business and I'm leaving, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And it's hard to, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like I have to lie sometimes and just be like, yeah, I'm an art teacher, you know?
Right. Right.
Because that's something more stable than what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's teaching moments, so maybe that's
sure,
not such a big lie.
Right. Right. Right.
But yeah.
it seemed like you were starting to anticipate my next question, which is whether your family is sort of getting adjusting and getting used to you being an artist and what that lifestyle is like. But if you're still sort of having to sort of fudge the reality that, you know, in fact, you don't have like a straight-ish job as an art teacher, you're just an artist, right? It sounds like there's still a lot of there's still a lot of evolving to go as far as who you are really to them.
Yes, totally. So it's so funny. We're talking about this because I had a conversation with my grandmother last night. She called me concerned because she heard that I was working through another family member. She heard that I was going to be busy for the next 3 weeks working every day on a project.
Mm-hmm.
And she called me and she's like, Justin, what do you mean? What do you mean you don't have any days off the next 2 weeks? What's going on with your job? And I said, well, Grandma, I'm an artist, you know, so I have to work every day on this. I'm going to be doing a big sculpture, a big installation. So I can't go anywhere. I'm busy. And she's like, okay, well, remember what I told you when you graduated college? She gives me this lecture like every other year, maybe.
Right.
she said, you need to have a job where you get a check every 2 weeks, no matter what.
Right.
As long as you do that, you'll be set. And I said, okay, well, that's not what's happening right now.
Right.
But, you know, so she gave me that lecture again last night, a grown ass man.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. Yeah.
You know, when one struggles with their certain relatives, whether it's a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, or, you know, or maybe even just like, I don't know, parents of your friends or whatever, sometimes it feels like you can go to a certain family member, you know, in some cases that's one of your parents, and it seems like, oh, I can finally sort of be honest, you know. But I'm guessing that although it's not as tricky a conversation with maybe your parents, it's still something that you struggle with. Is that fair?
Yeah, totally. And it's just family dynamics too. Sometimes it feels like bait and switch kind of thing. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, this is Justin. He's our artist. You know, he does this, he does that. We're so proud of him. And then the next day it's like, dude, you're 30 years old and you don't own a house. Like, get your shit together, you know? So it's like, what? Yesterday you said I was a great artist, and now you're telling me that I need to get my life together? Come
right,
on.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it's always like that. I'm already used to it, so I don't get my feelings hurt anymore, so it's fine.
You know, that makes me think about Mexican-American culture. And so just to for listeners, you're part Mexican heritage and part Guatemalan heritage. Do I remember that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And so one of the things, and this may be the case as much for Guatemalan Americans as Mexican Americans, but, you know, one of the big cliches is that family, you know, is everything, right? So, you know, you stay close to not only your parents, but your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, you know, your cousins, you know, so you just described, you know, why don't you have a house, that it's all about sort of having that stable job, settling into the community, and then everybody's like, you got all your houses on a block, right? And you can just walk to your, you know, the quinceañeras and whatever, you know, that's going on any given week, right?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I would just feel free to interpret that however you want.
Yeah, and I don't know. I always have to defend my position and say I don't want to own anything. I'm fine. This really pisses my mom off when I say I was born poor, and that's okay if I'm poor right now. Like, I'm used to it.
Right.
And of course, that brings on this whole thing. I didn't work here for you to do, you know what I mean? So I understand. I get it. Like, they want us to have a better life than they did. And I have to explain to them, like, I already have a better life than you did. Like, I have the privilege of sitting here in a studio thinking about my life and making artwork about it, like that, that is already way beyond anything that you were able to do. And I understand that, and I'm going to try to do well and be successful and make you guys proud, but it's going to take some time because the art world is weird.
Yeah.
And it has completely different rules. So it's, you know, the struggle is real, as they say.
Right.
So, so I'm in it. So I'm in it, and it just takes time.
Absolutely. Yeah, you must get a lot of clarity about what you're doing and why, having to sort of make those kinds of cases, you know, on a regular basis, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And
yeah, totally.
And you also made me think about the perspective you have about being okay with being poor, you know, which many of us artists have to be on some level. Has your experience been that the artists either in your peers, either now and or when you were in school, that many of them, whereas you sort of stayed the same, many of them are more downwardly mobile, you know, like they came from middle, upper middle, wealthy backgrounds, you know, and as they become artists, they go down, whereas you've either stayed the same or even gone up because, you know, you get to do what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to kind of resent those kind of people or just kind of want to shake them and be like, you don't even know what you have. Like, get your, you know, like,
right. Right.
Like you have all these resources. But when you're born with those resources and, you know, you really don't have to struggle or fight or work for anything, you don't realize what you have. So I think that's like one of the things that I'm really grateful for is like, ever since I was a kid, that's just the mentality we grew up with. It's like, you have to make something out of nothing. And that still rings true today for me. And I see that as a kind of a theme in my artwork and in my life. It's like, I'm just going to make something out of the little that I have, or even when I'm presented with, say, some money or certain opportunities, I use materials, for example, that are just available, and I don't really splurge on anything. I just make it work with what I have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that comes from my upbringing. But then sometimes when I have too many resources, I kind of get overwhelmed. For example, I have this studio right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in this weird funk a couple weeks ago and didn't make anything like for a couple weeks. And I felt really guilty about that because I have this space. Like, any artist would be so grateful to be here.
Right.
And I'm just like, I was stuck mentally, you know what I mean? And it's like, I had to kind of snap myself out of that. But it's kind of this cycle of you feeling bad about yourself. So then you don't get to work. And then it's, you know, it's just your classic case of depression there. But
yeah.
But still, that's just an example, right? Like, I have this giant studio. And before, when I just remember, and I flash back to like endless nights working in my garage in 95 degree weather, you know, like for years every day. Right. So it's this weird thing.
Don't you think, just from an artist's perspective, that there are periods like when you're working on a particular project or a particular piece, you know, you're driving through it, you know where you're going, you know what you need to do. But when you finish a piece or a series of pieces, you kind of have to sort of stop, figure out where you are, where you're going to go next, you know, because you can't necessarily figure those things out while you're finishing or working on, you know, the particular project you're working on, right? You kind of have to get to that end and then you have to kind of regroup, you know? So it sounds like even though maybe part of what you were doing was being depressed about something. Another part was just simply sort of a pause in the art making, which was this regrouping, right? And so you were feeling guilty about not taking advantage of this great space you had, but ultimately there can be something practical about just being in the space and not making anything. Wouldn't you agree?
Totally. And now that I'm not in that headspace anymore,
right,
that's what it was. It's like I burned myself out, and I wasn't even thinking about that, because I'm just thinking work, right? Like I have this space, work, right? But yeah, you're right. That's what it was. Like I needed to just take a step back and analyze things and put things into perspective, just like you said. Yeah.
Right.
Totally.
Well, speaking of work, you know, I sort of notoriously don't talk a lot about work on the show, but I think some of your work we kind of have to at least allude to. And if I were to use one word, at least judging by your site, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, it would be pinata. Is that fair?
That is, yes, that's very fair.
Good.
Yeah.
The first thing, though, that I wanted to ask you about or talk to you about, because you've done some performance pieces, what really pricked up my eyes and my brain was when I came across this piece that you did a couple years ago called Family Fiesta. And what was so interesting about that was where you did that, which is the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, which is the museum founded and funded by one of the Walmart heirs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So,
Alice Walton.
Yeah, exactly. So I just wonder, I mean, the first big question, you know, instead of beating around the bush, we should just get to it, is that you basically sort of created this pinata style picnic blowout type thing,
uh-huh.
right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Uh-huh.
And you did it on this or in this venue that, maybe as benign as it seemed when you were having the event, you know, was connected to Walmart and all of the troubling policy around labor, you know, especially going back to what we were talking about with your family.
Totally. Yeah, that was an interesting opportunity because I just had this vision of my family having a cookout at the entrance of the museum, and it made me laugh just thinking of the smell of the carne asada, you know, like wafting into Crystal Bridges,
right,
and the reason why that performance happened was because I had been thinking about how to incorporate my family into my work or collaborate with them in a way, because, you know, they're very important to me. And while I was at the museum, they had a birthday party for one of the curators in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And the theme of the party was Mexican theme.
Wow.
So I walk in, and it was like while I was doing a site visit, and I don't think they thought anything of it. And I walked in, and I was like, "What's happening? Like, is this for me? Like, what's going on here?"
Uh-huh.
And they had a pinata, pin the tail on the donkey. They had their Pandora Mexican playlist. They had rented a margarita machine and had like nachos.
Right.
And I was like, oh, wow, the way that my family celebrates is a style of party for these people.
Right.
Like, this is very interesting. So then when I got the opportunity to do programming there, to do a workshop, because it's the Walmart headquarters, there's really cheap flights from Vegas to Bentonville, Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
So with the budget they gave me for my workshop, I was able to fly out 15 of my family members.
Wow.
Because the flights are so cheap. And then that's when we did the party at the entrance of the museum as one of my workshops there. And yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking the whole time, is like, finally, like, Walmart that was the place where my family always shopped growing up. Mm. And now Walmart's giving me this opportunity to show my art and to bring my family out here and to, I mean, in a sense, critique what's happening here. But it was also about visibility. And
right.
I just wanted everybody that went into that museum that day to have to go through us and be a part of our celebration.
Mm-hmm.
It's really important to me for people of color to see themselves in those spaces.
Right.
And so that's what it was about. But then the performance just keeps kind of evolving. And what was the coolest thing that came out of that was not only a free trip for my family, which was awesome, but mm-hmm. I didn't realize I connecting. So the really cool thing was, because my family was there having this very, to us, normal celebration, it made us connect with the maintenance people at Crystal Bridges,
mm-hmm.
who all happened to be Mexican. So
uh-huh.
the Crystal Bridges, the museum, like the landscapers and some of the people that worked inside cleaning came out to the party with us and said, "Hey, this is really cool. Can we tell our families to come and join?" And we said, "Absolutely." So then by the end of the day, there was all of these brown people celebrating in front of Crystal Bridges. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't tell like who was my family and who were museum goers and who were the workers.
Right.
And I don't think that the workers' families had ever been engaged, you know, in any of the programming like that before. So that was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I was wondering, you know, especially looking at some of these pictures from the event, how much Mexican American, say, population there is in a place like Arkansas, particularly Bentonville.
There actually is a big population in the neighboring town.
Uh-huh.
It's called Springdale.
Uh-huh.
And the nickname is Chickendale because Tyson Chicken has a lot of like
factories there.
Or I don't know what they call them.
Right. Processing plants. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's where all the brown people are. That's where the jobs are.
Right. Right.
So Springdale has a very big, I think Central American Mexican community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Latino, I should say. Yeah.
Sure. And what led you to be invited to do a piece or performance or workshop, whatever you want to call it, at
the
museum?
They had a big show there called State of the Art. So it was basically like a survey of undiscovered contemporary artists across America.
Mm-hmm.
So there was 100 of us, and mm-hmm. I was one of the 25 that represented artists from the West.
Wow. That's great. And
yeah.
was it a museum curator who curated it?
Yeah, it was two. It was Chad Alleygood and Don Bacigalupi, I think that's how you say his name. Yeah, it was two curators that just traveled and visited thousands of studios for a couple of years to find everybody.
And they're both with Crystal Bridges?
I think Chad is still there. Don doesn't work there anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so in the process of your getting discovered or found for the show, were you in the sight lines of curators who were coming through Vegas? Was that kind of how it worked, or was it maybe a bigger venue that led their attention to you?
Yeah, they contacted Michelle Quinn, I think, here in Las Vegas. She's like a fine art advisor for a lot of the big casinos, or
mm-hmm.
and she helped curate the. So this is another thing that's happening in Vegas now. A lot of the casinos are investing in big time art.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the casinos hired her to kind of help find art for their spaces for this big compound called City Center,
mm-hmm, right.
which is like a big mall, casinos, hotel, apartments. they have their own fire station. That's how big this casino is.
Right.
So, anyway, so she tipped them off and she recommended certain artists in Las Vegas. So they, when they came to Vegas, they went to my house, to my garage, or Chad did. It was Chad Alleygood who came to my garage and that's how they found me.
Right. So this is the, this is, yeah, the garage that's your studio, that you will eventually be going back to and on the east side of Vegas.
Yes, got exactly.
Yeah. Right. Got it. Yeah. And what is it? Talk about what it's like being an artist in Vegas. I mean, it sounds like you're on one hand a big fish in a small pond. You know, I don't know if you'd put it that way, but that's my take on it. But I mean, I know, having talked to our mutual friend Maureen Halligan, that it's, mm-hmm, that there are a lot of things going on, but at the same time, it's also very difficult to kind of get people to come, you know, and to sort of further broaden the art community, because I think, I would imagine the rationale often goes something like, well, you know, Los Angeles is just 5 hours away, so why not just go there?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. Big fish in a big pond, in a small pond, uh-huh, is true, I think.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you're an artist and you want to get noticed, yeah, I think come to Vegas, because there is a lot of us, but the culture here, the people here are thirsty for it. So there is a lot of opportunities for artists here.
Right.
At this point, it's like, I think I've kind of like maxed out here. Like, not that I don't want to be here or people aren't going to show my work anymore, but people, there's certain artists here in Las Vegas that are like in every art show.
Right.
Right. So I have to be careful and like, not be in every art show, because people get sick of you after,
right,
a while.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. That's interesting. That's a good problem to have, isn't it? Kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great problem to have.
Right.
But I can kind of see it when people are like, oh, there's another pinata hanging in City Hall, you know, like,
right.
Great.
Yeah. 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 I get it. Right. I guess the other side of that though, is that while that's going on, as far as you're feeling like you're, you know, you've outgrown the area, is if you're able to continue showing throughout the rest of the country, you know, that it seems like that would be the necessary ingredient to allow you to feel comfortable sticking around.
Yeah. So that's kind of my shtick right now.
It's right.
Like I'm representing Vegas across the United States. So now, actually I'm going to go to the UK, and be in John Walter's show, who was just on your,
oh, no kidding,
just on your podcast.
Right, right.
In Shonky. So now international. There you go.
That's great.
So, but yeah, so that's kind of been my routine now. Is like, now I try to get in shows, you know, elsewhere, but Vegas is always my home base. Vegas,
yeah,
is a great place to work, I think, for an artist. So
right.
Now I want to make Vegas proud and maybe, you know, put it on the map, or just like this, start a conversation about, wait, there's artists in Las Vegas? What's going on over there? You know?
Right. Well, there was the whole, yeah, there was the whole UNLV period with a number of artists around Dave Hickey, you know, when he was there.
Yes.
So that was obviously,
yes,
what, that was like, I don't know, 15 years ago, something like that, maybe more. I don't know,
yeah,
to what extent. You know, that was obviously a time where Vegas was really on the map in a certain way. And
totally.
I don't know if that was a big part of your contemporary art education, or, you know, what, how you look back on that, not really having experienced it, presumably, right?
I showed up to UNLV after the party was over. Like,
right,
the place was trash. Like, it was like, people were bitter, like, it was not good. I'm friends with a lot of the Dave Hickey guys, but I'm not, I didn't get any of that education or wasn't part of that movement. They're definitely still here. All those artists are still work. A lot of them are still working here,
right?
And still making work. So yeah. It's still that, you know, that group of people is still here, kind of shaping the art here in Las Vegas.
So when you're in these group shows that you're, you know, with your pinata or whatever that you're worried about, you know, am I in too many group shows? Are you in group shows with these guys as well, or are you more with younger?
Yeah.
Artists? Yeah. Uh-huh.
No, it's a mixture here. It's a mixture here of, right. of those guys and those people, I should say. They're not all guys. There's a couple girls in there, you know.
Right.
They have to let the token woman and brown person in each show. But that's been really cool to work with those guys on a lot of levels. I've had a couple shows with like a two-person show with a couple of them, and it's been really great.
Mm-hmm. So another one of your performance, another version, I guess, of your performance, the one you did at the Crystal Bridges with the sort of the pinata blowout, you know, Mexican party, you did also at Michael Heiser's Double Negative in the desert. And there are some great pictures on your website. And I think the first question that I have about it is, what was the bureaucracy like getting permission to do that?
We did not.
No kidding.
We just went and did it. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. We just went and did it. It's the desert. It's our desert. And
right.
I didn't feel like I was crossing any lines. And we were very respectful of the space. My family didn't understand what it was, but that was the main thing. I was like, guys, we got to be respectful. We can't, you know, damage anything, and mm-hmm. we have to clean up afterwards. But other than that, let's go party.
Right.
That was it. So
right. Yeah,
we had a big party inside of Double Negative.
Yeah. And you had, these balloons and streamers like going across the width of the canyon basically. Right. So
it
seems like that's the kind of thing that could potentially go viral. I don't know. I mean, it's always hard for art things to go viral, but I mean, did you feel like you got much traction from that kind of imagery?
I don't know. It could have been bigger. I think if it was big, the thing was, is when I do those performances, I don't decorate anything. It's all my family. So that was my aunt's idea to string them across Double Negative like that.
I see. Got it.
So, but I did, I think it wasn't juxtaposed, but mm-hmm. It didn't, I'm actually kind of happy that it didn't blow up, 'cause I didn't want to get in trouble.
Right.
So.
Right. Do you think could you have been liable somehow just for not having gotten some kind of permit?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. It's like, I didn't make any money off of it. We didn't really do any damage to it other than, I mean, the whole piece is about entropy anyway. So like,
right.
So it's, I don't know. I felt like it was fine. It was fine. It was a fun day. And then that's what it was about, is just kind of like, not taking that space so seriously and just
right.
like treating it as a community space, and then like and you know, just having one of those fiestas again, you know, as institutional critique, right?
Yeah.
And it's about institutional inclusion.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I don't think they ever thought there would be a full on Mexican fiesta inside of one of Michael Heiser's earthworks.
Right.
As
you were doing an institutional critique and also having fun, was there part of you that wanted to have your family experience, you know, this work, or was it kind of was maybe not the time for that? Because it was like you were giving your family exposure to, you know, contemporary art, which is something that on a regular basis, I presume, doesn't happen other than through your work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the cool part. I think it's like my family isn't as intimidated by art anymore as they used to, or museum
mm-hmm.
spaces,
mm-hmm.
because the latest one we did was actually on the roof of the Nevada Museum of Art in Reno. I haven't posted the photographs of that one yet. We just did that one a couple months ago.
Right.
And, yeah, they now see museum spaces as places to party. So literally after every family fiesta, they say, okay, when's the next one?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
right.
it's kind of become a tradition. We do one every year now.
Right.
So, yeah, I think it's, I didn't know it would happen, but that's what it's doing. It's breaking down those walls with my family.
That's great.
And they're not really asking questions. They're, because my family's so badass, they just, whatever you need, Mijo, you want us to go do a party? Okay, we'll be there. You know, like, there's never questions asked. What do you need me to bring? You know,
right.
That's it. That's the questions they ask.
That's nice.
We'll do it. You know, if we can get the time off, we'll go. So, but yeah, that's something that's been happening.
That's great.
It's cool.
Yeah. Another thing that people should know about you is that I would presume it's safe to say that you're a big foodie, right?
I'm just going to
further introduce that element by pointing out that you do a podcast yourself called Latinos Who Lunch. So, we talked about this a little bit before, so I guess before I let you respond, I just wanted to clarify whether Latinos Who Lunch, I'm going to just presume that it's a combination, that it sort of evolved as a combination of getting together with your fellow Latinos and being a show for foodies. Is that fair?
Yes, and it's also... my co-host is an art historian and I'm an artist. So it's also a comment on the art world. So it's a take on the term ladies who lunch, who are usually the ladies raising money for institutions like museums.
Right. Oh, that's very smart.
So
that's very smart.
Yeah. So we talk about art and museums a lot in our, well, it's sprinkled in here and there.
Right.
Because that's the world we're in, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah.
And your co-podcaster, art historian, it's a he, right? Is he a fellow Vegas resident?
Yeah, he was born in L.A., but yeah, he actually is finishing his doctorate right now at UNM.
Mm-hmm.
So he lives in Albuquerque, but his whole family's here. So his name is Emmanuel Ortega, and he comes for a few days a month. So when he's here, we record like two or three podcasts.
Got it.
And then he goes back to Albuquerque.
Okay.
He should be done by this summer.
So I was a little off base because it sounds like you talk more about art related things than food related things.
Well, we talk about whatever, but
right. The
food is the entry point. And then that's something we start every podcast eating a meal and describing what we're eating.
Okay.
And then that leads us either into having a conversation about that food and tying it to another subject, or it's just we eat, you know, hey, today we're eating a Guatemalan tamal that my grandma made. What do you think about it? Okay, now we're going to talk about RuPaul. You know, it's just kind of a thing that to get an icebreaker. I guess.
Right.
What do you think
about
people?
What do you think about RuPaul, Justin?
I love RuPaul.
Uh-huh.
The show RuPaul's Drag Race is one of my favorite TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
It's groundbreaking, and we're in a time right now where that show might not exist for much longer, and I've learned so much from that show and from RuPaul kind of saying like things are cyclical. Like right now we're free to have a show where men dress up as women, and it's entertaining and it's fun, and it's going to be taken away soon, and that's kind of how it rolls. So I love RuPaul. He is problematic in a lot of ways, but who isn't?
So you're really that, I mean, we should say, since you did allude to it indirectly,
uh-huh.
that we are on the Thursday before the inauguration. Oh. Ouch, right? But are you really that worried that things are going to be so bad that a show, a TV show such as this, among others, is going to be taken off the air? You really think that we're going to enter into that kind of Orwellian state?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, if you look at it, there's just different. I mean, there's just different stages that kind of our media goes through. Like once certain voices are amplified and have power, sometimes those people are silenced again. And that's something that I learned from listening to RuPaul's podcast and watching his shows, is like RuPaul was huge in the 90s. He was a supermodel of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we didn't hear from him for like 20 years, right? Because it was too much. Like, okay, like you're good. Be quiet.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And now he's back. And now he's back. It's just something that happens. Like,
yeah,
you know, just like in politics, we had two terms of a Democratic candidate. Like, it was too much for the country. Now it's back. You know, like it's just history. History does repeat itself over and over again in every aspect.
Right, right.
I mean, it does. It does get better maybe every time.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, that's kind of that's kind of what I'm thinking. I mean, I see your point as far as cycles, but the degree to which LGBT rights and inclusion have spread, you know, it's much different than it was in the early 2000s. You know, so despite whatever is coming, and I know this is turning to more of a political thing, but I just wanted to make that counterpoint before we get too deep into that. So going back to your foodie element, one of your projects, and I don't know if this is still ongoing, but it's called Taco Takeover. Do you want to talk about what that is?
I just ate a taco a couple days ago. Okay, so this is what's happening right now. All my taco takeovers were documented on the app and the website Vine.
Okay.
And so the project Taco Takeover started in 2014 after Taco Bell came out with the Doritos Locos Tacos.
Okay.
And which is a taco in a Dorito shell.
Right.
And I thought, what the hell is a taco now? Like, what is happening?
Right.
To a taco?
Right.
And I started reading about just the globalization of Mexican food and just like, oh my God, white people are taking our food and just like going crazy with it. This needs to end.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm taking the taco back.
Right.
Physically, literally.
Right.
So that's when I started documenting every taco that I ate. So if I went to a restaurant and there was a taco, because now, especially you're in California, like if you go to any place, most places have tacos on the menu. Even at a fancy restaurant, sometimes they'll have like, you know, fish tacos, right? That's like a big thing at a lot of bars too. Like there's tacos everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started documenting them by taking these short videos of me consuming the taco and then putting them on a map, on a Google map.
Right.
And then so if you go onto the Taco Takeover Google map, you can click on a location and then watch me eat the taco at that location. And in a way, I don't know why, but that makes me feel like I'm the authority on that taco in that location because I've eaten it.
Right.
So, and I've taken that taco back for better or for worse.
Right.
Kind of thing. So it's funny, but it's also serious. Like I just want to see what tacos are across the nation or across the world, like what they have evolved into.
Yeah, or devolved in some cases, right?
Devolved.
Yeah.
That's better.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that from now on.
Good, good. Did you Devolved. Actually try the nacho Taco Bell taco?
Oh, absolutely. I tried every flavor. So here's the thing too. I actually love Taco Bell.
Okay.
But
guilty pleasure?
But I don't. Yes, totally. And I don't think of it as a Mexican food though. I just think of it as its own
right.
its own thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Taco Bell is its own thing. It's not. It's an American food for sure.
Right. You know how they talk about
yeah.
Particularly with McDonald's, they talk about the food having literally certain chemicals in it that induce addiction or sort of help,
yep.
you know, inspire
yep.
addiction. I assume that's the case with a place like Taco Bell as well. And just as part of to further look at the bigger picture, I would imagine that when you go to your more, you know, your taco trucks, your more pure sort of version of the taco, that you don't get that kind of chemical element. Is that your
yeah.
experience?
Yeah. 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 That's called the Dorito effect, actually.
The Dorito effect. Got
so
it.
That,
right.
Yeah.
Right. That's a
and
good
then,
point.
So they literally just put a Dorito. They're like, oh yeah, let's just put a Dorito around it.
Right.
Cause that's what a Dorito is.
Yeah.
A Dorito is just chemicals.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Got yeah.
it. Yeah. So it's your, I mean, as part of your foodie life and foodie, you know, exploration, would you say that generally the best food is sort of the purest? Because, you know, it represents either a local, you know, food culture, or it represents the food culture of where it originally came from, but it's not over-doctored, you know? I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm just trying to get you to describe
yeah.
the bigger picture, but also like the taco that is the complete opposite of the Dorito taco.
Okay, so this is an ongoing research project. So this the evidence so far,
uh-huh.
the study so far has not led to a conclusion.
Okay,
but just certain observations that maybe I didn't think about before or see before. So this has challenged my idea of the authentic. So,
mm-hmm.
Before when I would see authentic Mexican cuisine, I thought I knew what that meant. And now that I've traveled more, that I've eaten over 250 tacos, like that has totally changed. Because like you said, the ingredients of a taco or the way that a taco is made changes depending on what region it's from.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it when you say, you have to be very specific, like, wow, this taco is authentic to Sonora, Mexico. This is like a northern Mexican taco from this town. Because when you're in Mexico, the cuisine literally changes from town to town, like the
right.
way that they make a taco.
Right.
So then that goes out the window now when I think of authentic. Well, I mean, for what I think is a good taco, to me, a good taco is a taco that is, it sounds so cheesy, but I'm just going to say it, that's made with love and with like consideration for each ingredient on that dish,
sure.
on that taco.
Right.
So you can go to... I have been to an authentic, I'm doing air quotes here,
mm-hmm.
to an authentic Mexican restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and I get served a taco with a cold tortilla.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the ingredient is correct, but that tortilla, there was no attention paid to that tortilla. Like, it wasn't even heated. Like, get this out of here, you
right,
know? Like,
right.
So when I go to places like Taco Bell, every ingredient in a Taco Bell taco is there, and it serves the purpose, be it flavor, texture, temperature. So to me, that's a good taco because everything is super intentional.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go to my favorite taco truck in Vegas, and you know, the tortilla is basted in animal fat and put on a grill, and slices of pineapple are roasted and put on top of the meat. Everything is intentional. Everything is carefully put together and constructed, and that's what makes a good taco.
Wow. So you're saying that despite the Taco Bell taco being, I think we kind of agreed that it's a little rogue, if for lack of a better word, but you're saying that it has a lot of parallels with this sort of your favorite taco truck taco because everything's intentional.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Do you have here? So here's the thing that you made me think of as you're describing the food itself. When you have a Taco Bell taco compared with that taco truck taco that you mentioned, do you get more of a food hangover from the Taco Bell taco?
Yes.
Yes.
Food hangover.
Thank
That's
you.
The perfect way of describing
it. Yeah, yeah. It's like when you eat a donut, you know, if you're particularly if you're on the sensitive side, you know, you feel it for the rest of the day.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
I don't even know why people eat donuts anymore. Donuts make me feel like shit every time I eat donuts.
Right.
I always eat them when they're there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
So getting back to your work, this is the moment in the show where I love sort of getting into these tangents, but I also, part of me as the host is wondering, oh, does the listeners want to hear about tacos? Well, they
Let's
just did. So
donuts.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I wanted to get really specific about your work for a second, because in addition to, or sort of parallel to the pinata pieces that you've done, you do sort of you do these sort of wall versions, or have done these wall versions of these of that sort of style with this layered paper, you know, a lot of little pieces of layered paper. And so my question is, it seems like these are pretty labor intensive, especially in the case of this this motel that you turned into like a pinata motel. So my question was going to be, did you get some help to put that together?
Oh, yeah. When I do stuff on big scale like that,
I
have to have help, or else that Pinata Motel, we pulled that together in 5 days. I don't know how we did it.
Wow.
It was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was just one color. Well, it was like three colors. So
right.
That also helped. But like, I was just doing an installation in Denver at the Denver Art Museum, and I had 3 weeks to do it. And it took me 3 weeks to cover three walls in that space. So it's very labor intensive with four assistants.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you covered three walls in the Denver Museum, and it was five of you working together over 3 weeks?
Yeah.
How long were the days?
8 hours. 8 hours a day.
Right. Okay. So it wasn't inhuman.
Yeah.
It wasn't an inhuman amount of work.
No.
Right.
No, the labor unions here in Las Vegas have taught me well.
That's great.
I even bought them lunch every day, hour lunches. You know,
nice.
I'm a nice boss.
You are.
I'm a nice boss.
Yeah. So good for you. Good. Thank you for being a nice boss. So when you're making work, whether it's with helpers like that, assistants like that, or whether you're doing it just alone in your studio, what is your routine as far as, because it's usually pretty rote type of work, right? Or, you know, it's a labor intensive process. So are you listening to things? Are you, you know, doing meditative type things? Are you doing a combination? What's your routine as far as that?
Personally, I love podcasts. So
because
of, like you said, because it's so labor intensive.
Yeah.
I love music too, but I can't, when I love listening to people talk, because that actually helps me zone out and concentrate on the conversation.
Right.
When I listen to music, a lot of the times I'm still in my own head. So it's very taxing to me. It's too much. So I love to listen to conversations, but when I'm working with a group of people, it's usually music though.
Right.
I just let them pick what they want.
Got it.
And I have to suffer, but I mean, it's not like I'm really suffering, but I want to, you know, make sure everybody's happy. So when I have a big group helping me, it's usually music. And then when it's by myself, it's listening to podcasts.
Right. So other than RuPaul's podcast, what podcast do you listen to?
Oh my gosh, so many.
Yeah.
Well,
I might be able to pick up some new ones to try podcast. Out.
You know what I just listened to that's really good is Making Oprah.
Wow.
Have you heard of that one?
No. What's that about?
It's a three-part podcast, and it's all about how Oprah went from like this kind of news anchor reporter in Baltimore to the Oprah Winfrey we know now.
Right.
It's an amazing podcast.
Okay.
It's only three parts. It's only three episodes, and there's a couple bonus little things here and there. Mm-hmm. But I recommend that one.
Okay.
So the reason why we started our podcast, Latinos Who Lunch, was because I couldn't find any Latino-centric conversational podcasts online like there was Black podcasts. So some of my favorite podcasts now are still those Black podcasts that I found many years ago when it's just like two people talking. Sometimes it's like hot topics, like what happened the week before, and then they just bullshit kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is The Read.
Mm-hmm.
The Read is really awesome. BuzzFeed has Another Round, which is really good.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's this podcast called For Colored Nerds.
Mm-hmm.
And that one is what we kind of base Latinos Who Lunch on. And then, oh my gosh, there's just so many. I literally have like 30 podcasts on my favorites list. So
that's great.
The Sporkful is really good.
I listen to that one.
Podcast.
I listen to that one. Yeah, of course.
Oh,
that makes sense
so
for you.
Good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right.
Yeah, I love that. I love that podcast.
You should be nominated as a guest. When he comes around to Vegas, you would definitely be a good guest for that show.
Yeah, good. Oprah, put that out into the universe. good. Let's manifest that. Dan Pashman,
right.
Listen up.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So you
thank
mentioned.
Thank you.
You bet. So going back to the since you said the Colored Nerds podcast kind of inspired your Latinos Who Lunch. Tell me what that's about.
So For Colored Nerds is two friends living in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And, Brittany Luce is one of the hosts of that show. She works for Gimlet Media now.
Okay.
Who also has really amazing podcasts,
right.
You know, like Reply All and Mystery Show and all those really great ones. Anyway, so their podcast is conversational, but they also do a little bit of research. And they pick a topic every time. So it's in the beginning, they catch up, they check in with each other, and then they get into it. So, you know, they had their latest episode was about the TV show Atlanta. Some of their past episodes are like, they get into Stevie Wonder or there's just so many, you know, the art world, Black art, contemporary artists, Michelle Obama. So they choose someone or a topic and they go off about it for about an hour. And that's basically the format of Latinos Who Lunch.
And are the hosts of For Color Nerds Black?
Yes.
Okay. So the reason I ask is because are there any Latino podcasters that are, you know, or and is that even important to you? Yeah.
Totally. So when we were searching for that, when I was searching for that Latino podcast, like I said, that's why we started ours, because there really wasn't anything like it.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time that we were doing that, so many other Latinos started their own podcast too. So now we're part of I want to say it's a movement of Latino podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a few podcasts in LA that we have contributed to and like are really good friends with.
Mm-hmm.
There's this podcast called Tamarindo Podcast that we connected with, and we've done their podcast. They've come on ours. There's this podcast that's like Latina mom centric called Super Mamas.
Mm-hmm.
And we've collaborated with them, and now there's dozens of them that we that we have connect. There's one about funded by Reform Immigration for America. It's an immigration-based podcast. That one called Choices and Cheesemas. We're really good friends with them. So now there's this really great. There's all these really great Latino podcasts to choose from, and I hope that the community kind of just keeps growing, because the more podcasts, the better, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's great. So you're really a cheerleader for the growth of the Latino podcast community, and already you are describing a real community, like, you know, that you go on each other's shows and, you know, you're friends with each other and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, it's awesome. And I think it's blowing up. Like we're talking about getting together in LA this summer to like do like a, what do they call it? A convention or, just do some live shows and just get together and start supporting each other that way too.
Right. Now, yeah. Sorry to be a little selfish here, but based on what we have sort of alluded to, with the art world, just very briefly in earlier in the episode, would it not surprise you that, the art podcasts are not a community and not particularly friendly with each other?
You think they're not a community, or do you, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think they, at most, they're aware of each other, you know, but at worst, they, I don't know. I don't want to put words in their mouth, but there's,
no.
I don't feel like it's much of a community. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think you're right about that, because I do have my list of art podcasts, and I never hear them, like, giving shout outs to other art podcasts kind of thing.
Right.
And that's probably just like a built-in thing where, I don't know, like, is the art world exclusionary, like, on all mediums, like, on
right.
all forms? You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, I think we're kind of in different parts of the country, you know, that's part of it. I know that I believe there are a couple here in L.A., but I haven't had any communication with them. You know, I've been told it's the kind of thing where, you know, hey, the more the merrier, but, I mean, I did have Tyler Green of the Modern Arts mm-hmm. podcast on this show a while back, and
awesome.
I have not had a return offer. Not too surprisingly. You know, I don't know what it is. I guess we're just kind of all doing our own thing, and just because it's art doesn't mean that we're on the same page, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a great observation. Yeah. I think you're right.
Yeah.
And
I mean, how do you guys make it look so easy is basically what I'm getting at. In your food communities, in your Latino communities. I mean, maybe art is just the great excluder. I don't know.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. No, I'm actually going to pay more attention to that. That's the thing, is like, when it's not brought to your attention, you're not even thinking about that. But like, I mean, you know, social conscious podcasts, you know, race relations, they're always on my mind. So I'm always thinking about that.
Right.
And I think as a person of color, you're always thinking about that. And if you're in any kind of competitive, I mean, I guess anywhere is a competitive workplace, right?
Yeah.
That's always in the back of your head, in the back of your mind. So, I mean, even in the Latino communities, if somebody's doing better than you, just like anywhere else, there's always this little bit of you that hates on somebody. You know what I mean?
Because
it's, they're in a way, they're checking you, and it makes you think about the work that you're doing and if you're doing enough. But that's something that I've consciously had to put aside and work past myself.
Right.
Is like, no. This podcast, Latinos Who Lunch, is about amplifying other voices, not just giving us a voice, but giving other voices like ours a platform.
Right.
And that was a conscious decision from the very beginning. So
yeah,
maybe that's not the same mentality a lot of these art podcasts have.
Yeah, it's definitely different. And speaking of thinking about, you know, being conscious of race what you said about how that's something you think about on a regular basis. When we talked last time, I remember you described growing up in Vegas and being, you know, the Latino kid or something to that effect, right? That was something that you were conscious of. Because didn't you say that at one point you were going to a school that was pretty much all white except for a few of you?
It was a lot of Mormons, yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So the thing that I was getting to was that things have changed a lot, right? I mean, to what extent in your daily life now in Vegas do you find that comes up, that you're made aware of your race as opposed to when you were growing up?
Oh, okay. Well, now it's every day, but now it's on my terms, which is different.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's what art and this podcast have allowed me to do, is like really get in touch with my identity, with my Latinidad, and take the reins, right? Like now I'm telling my own story, when before it was people were just putting on their ideas of who I was on me, and that's who I was performing as, because
right,
that's what I thought I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What is it now that makes you put it out there initially? Even, you know, you say it's your terms, but what is it that's making it? What is it that makes you want to announce it in the first place? If things are more, what's the word I'm looking for? I was going to say things are less. I mean, in other words, I would assume that you're in the presence of fellow Latinos in daily life more than you were when you were growing up.
Yeah. Actually, I don't know about that.
No,
I feel like now I'm actually surrounded by less Latinos physically.
Mm-hmm.
I think now because of the internet, this is what happens, is now we have our real life situations, our real life identities, and then we have our online identities, which
mm-hmm.
are totally different.
Right.
And I try to keep that as genuine as possible. Again, you have to make a conscious decision. Like, what am I posting every day? Like, am I this, I don't know. Some people's identities online are just like, I'm a Chicano activist through and through. That's all I do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But in real life, they're just sitting in the room all day. So what's up with that? So,
right.
But I guess beyond that is I try to keep my presence online and in real life pretty accurate, pretty the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just because I guess, like I'm saying, I'm conscious of that idea of, you know, identity as performance, but also it's my artwork that I'm always championing or talking about or thinking about.
Right. So in other words, are you suggesting then that you're, because of your art, which reflects your background, your heritage, and your, you know, concerns about identity, that's what's coloring your, you know, what's in front of you, whether it's in real life, you know, in the flesh or online?
Yeah. And I think now I think I'm putting in the work when it comes to actually understanding what's happening in the I guess academically, like
mm-hmm.
what I'm doing, when
mm-hmm.
before I didn't know how to communicate what I was feeling or what I was doing. And maybe
right.
I'm not doing a very good job of that now, but I just feel like maybe now I have a better vocabulary for that, or it's just, I do feel like I am I do feel like I'm closer to the Latino community now. And when I say Latino community, I just mean this, like, I just mean Latinos in the United States in general.
Mm-hmm.
When before, I think I would be with my family more often, so I was literally surrounded by Latinos more, you know.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But now, since I'm in the art world, I'm podcasting. I mean, I'm still keeping in touch with those Latinos around me, but I'm also in different. I'm breaking through different spaces in the same way.
Right. Well, you mentioned a second ago getting to how you're feeling. So how are you feeling? I mean, obviously, that's a very general question, but, you know, and changes all the time. But as far as what we're talking about, you mentioned that in the context of sort of academically trying to think through what you're feeling and as far as your work. What is the question I'm trying to ask? Is trying to figure out what you're feeling related to what you're going through as an artist, through what you're going through as a Latino, all of those things at the same time? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I feel right now I'm feeling like I'm finally figuring out who I am. And that is comforting because I've always been proud to be who I am.
Right.
But now I have all these different platforms that I can influence or talk to other people with or influence other people with. And it's a very exciting time for me right now, so I'm very excited. But then I'm also being very careful and I'm just aware that I don't know everything and that I just need to keep learning. And that's what's really exciting to me right now is that every time I make an artwork, every time I do a podcast, every time I go talk at, you know, wherever, it opens up another door and forces me, really. What this is doing is like forcing me to have to know my shit because people are going to check me on that.
Right.
So now I'm really into my culture and really into my identity because people are always asking me about it. And I have to be ready to talk about it. So it's really motivated me more than ever before to, you know, to read, to listen to podcasts, and just to be aware of what's happening, not only in my own studio, but politically in the world.
Right.
Like, for example, this is like really the first time that I've been aware of what's happening in politics, because now I know that it affects everybody and affects my people in a big way.
Yeah. I have to ask, based on what you just said, did you in 2012, and so you're 30, right? So
yeah,
2017, so 2012, 2008. Yeah. So you were old enough to vote in 2008. Did you vote in 2012 and 2008?
Yes,
okay.
Did vote.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
Right, good.
No, totally. I had a really great teachers in high school,
mm-hmm.
a government teacher, actually, that was really influential and made sure that we knew how important voting was. So because of her, shout out to Miss Jones.
Nice.
I've always voted no matter what. Yeah.
Good.
But
good. Mm-hmm.
As a kid, as an 18-year-old or whatever, when you're voting, I didn't really know who I was voting for. You know,
sure.
I just voted for the party that I aligned with.
Right. Got it. Well, Justin, we could keep going, but I think we've covered a ton, don't you?
Yeah. That was a lot from tacos to voting.
Yeah, exactly. And then some.
Good.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you, Justin. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the podcast.
Absolutely. And we're out.
Thanks so much again to Justin Favela for talking to us. I really enjoyed talking to him. I hope you did as well. Great talking with a fellow podcaster for a change. Even better that it's in a different field than contemporary art. Wink, wink. Thank you guys so much for listening to this show. Again, if you would be so kind to support the show financially, either through Patreon or PayPal, it would be extremely appreciated. You can also support the show by becoming a fan, follower on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, at Artist Podcast. And you can leave a nice review on iTunes. That will help more people find this podcast, which, as I've said before, is crucial to growing the base, which is certainly helpful. So that you can find at theconversationpod.com as well. Yeah, so about that political moment, as we're recording this, it is the 28th of January. We're just, 7 or 8 days into the new regime. And so I think that looking back on Justin's alarm about RuPaul's Drag Race and shows like it being taken off the air, now all of a sudden that doesn't seem quite so impossible at all, does it? So I'm going to give credit to Justin for being maybe more prescient than paranoid. All right. Kudos to you, Justin. Thanks again for listening to the show. I will talk to you again next week. Ciao for now.